it wasn't, it didn't make a lot of sense geographically to have these three clinics together, but they were also at the point that it made sense to do something. So we applied for the National Health Service for a position for myself. And there was a board composed of people from Norma, Petros, and Stony Fork. Yeah.
That's where the Mountain People's Health Councils with an S comes in.
Right.
You know, that's something that simple. You know, I've heard people as I tell them the name, and they're like,
"Why is it
council? Why is it plural?"
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, because there were multiple councils at one time, and I try to explain that. You know, it was.
That was one of the problems and the advantages.
Right.
Carol can talk more to that, but
yeah.
The initial. Well, you can talk about the initial administrator, Dwayne.
Yes, Dwayne Sexton was the first administrator.
All right, hang on. Before we get started, I have more pens.
Maybe I can just mention before we start what I'm doing here
yes.
in terms of the archive, archiving
yes.
components.
Yes.
See how small this is?
Wow. It felt really light, too. Oh, my goodness. That's great. It's mostly lens, right?
Yeah.
So, James, when you were out of the room, I was just mentioning that I wanted to just briefly say why I'm here and what we're doing in terms of our archiving component, and I just want to make sure you all are comfortable with what we might do with recordings and video and photos. So, like I said, I come from UNC Chapel Hill, and I'm an archivist there, and so we're working with the alums of the Student Health Coalition to document their history and the communities in which they worked. And so we're going around, we've been doing field work and recordings like this, and we'd like to archive it in the library at UNC Chapel Hill and make it available and get that history out there. So I just wanted to lay that out for you and make sure you're comfortable with us recording your image and voice and archiving it.
Absolutely. We're learning along the way.
Okay.
I mean, I think we've got, and you'll meet, like I said, a lot of the board members that you're going to remember, that they know this history. And that's what I was talking to Paul earlier. You know, as you're talking and you ask them, they're like, oh, yeah. And they could probably tell me some of the stories, but it's not like they just regularly share it. And
right.
it's not really, there's not any historical documentation of where, I mean, it's there. But, you know, all those people that were there at the beginning, we need to be getting that information now.
Well, that's actually how we got started on all of it.
Yes.
Not just related to Mountain Peoples, but the whole organizing thing that came out of Vanderbilt and involved students from there who were involved I think at one point we had organized something like 26 rural clinics. Now, not all of them survived. In fact, a relatively small percentage of them did.
I see, that's what's amazing. Now, with those three original clinics, how many, I mean, were, just based on the era, they had to be one of the first clinics in Tennessee, weren't they? I mean, one of.
Yes.
As far as I know, other than in Memphis,
mm-hmm.
and I'm blocking on the guy's name, he's a public health guy that there for years and years, and he set up a whole series of clinics in Memphis. But other than that, in terms of community-based clinics, there really wasn't anything.
How many were there, like, I'm sure because of the poverty level and you know, rural Appalachia, I'm sure there were lots of these clinics around, or were there? I guess, how many?
Around here that we were involved in? Yeah. There were clinics, let me see if I can, there were clinics in obviously, going from south to north. Petros, Stony Fork, Norma, and then it was Clearfield, White Oak, Frakes, Kentucky,
and
Laurel Fork,
and those were a group up north of La Follette,
right, in the Clear Fork Valley.
And some of those still exist and are Dayspring.
So
some of those relate
Mark
to
Watt
Dayspring
up there.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's
and then there were.
Briceville,
right. We also had West Tennessee clinics, but
Robbins,
which we need to find out about, because one of the people that's involved in this spent a summer, more than a summer, really working in Robbins.
Oh, wow.
And she sent me some questions that she really was interested in finding out about Robbins.
Well, now, James Walker was one of the, and I think there was Mountain Peoples, and then there was like a Robbins Foundation. I forget the name of it.
Uh-huh.
But they actually combined those two, and the Robbins facility became part of Mountain Peoples.
That was after my time.
And that's one that James Walker, because he was on, he originally, I think, came to Mountain Peoples through the affiliation with the Robbins Clinic.
Okay.
And that's one that, you know, if you talk to him, that's just old news to him.
Right.
And I want to apologize early. I'll be asking a lot of questions. Do not let me hijack this from you.
Well, yes.
We're learning from you as much as we can.
Well, I was thinking that some of what we're talking about right now we might want to do with the staff.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Because I'm sure they're, you know, would like to hear some of that. And now that you say James Walker's name, I remember, I don't think he was on the board when I was here.
He may not have been.
But in 2001, the Tennessee Primary Care Association celebrated its 25th anniversary, and it was in Upper East, I think Johnson City. And Jan Laxton and James Walker came to that, and I came down from Pennsylvania, and that's when I met him. He came as, I guess, the board chair with Jan Laxton. And that's funny. I'd forgotten about that, but that is how I know him.
Yeah, he's still our board chair.
Yep.
So we're very fortunate that we've got a group of people that, you know, they remember, because when I got here, it's changed. You know, we've been very blessed. There's tons of opportunities out there,
mm-hmm.
and we're thankful for that, but. You know, a lot of the board members went through a time when money was tight, to say the least. You know, they're my understanding, kind of struggling to pay the bills. The reason I bring that up is because it's real good to have that group of people that have been through the hard times as well as, and now that we're doing well,
mm-hmm.
they don't go crazy with it. I mean, it's like, you know, when you've had to scrimp and struggle to get by, it makes you really appreciate the good times.
Especially in healthcare, because
yes.
things can change very quickly in a bad way.
Yeah.
In terms of reimbursement issues, and you know, it's a challenging business.
Well, you know, even like right now, I mean, I'm sure you're aware, we technically went over the funding cliff.
Yeah.
Oh, did they not renew 330?
And they, you know, the scary part, my understanding, you know, is that what community health centers do is bipartisan. It's hard not to get behind it, you know, making sure that people have access to care. And, you know, Republicans, Democrats, everybody supports it. It's mm-hmm. just an easy thing to do. You know, and particularly because the program actually winds up saving more money than you spend on it. How many programs can you say that about in the United States government? But since everybody's for it, it almost takes a back seat to where we'll get it. Yeah, we would never forget about you guys.
Yeah.
And it just makes you worry that we are the proverbial baby and the bad waters that got to get thrown out.
I had heard that, you know, CHIP didn't get renewed, but the last time I talked to Bill Corr, he said that in the administration's budget, they had included funding, pretty much level funding for 330, which is the money for federally qualified health centers, federal money. But now you say they didn't, it went over the cliff on September 30th?
Yeah, my understanding, yes, it did. But again, it's not one of those where, I don't think you see a lot. There's money there that'll last through January, is my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And they figure that that it will be fixed before then, and everybody's confident that it will. And
but that's always
the
kiss
of death. Confidence is not something I think about in terms of American healthcare system right now.
We've all got our fingers crossed. Everything lines up. We're doing what we're supposed to do. It's a great program. Everybody supports it. But until it's fixed, it's not fixed.
Right.
I mean, Carol mentioned Bill Kaur. I don't know if you know the story of...
Well, you met Bill Kaur because he was one of the other founders who came to the board meeting back in May.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
It was Erwin Venick, who's going to be here today.
Yeah.
And Bill Kaur and I were at that Primary Care Association meeting. And Bill, go ahead.
Well, Bill was a Vanderbilt law student who fell in with us doing stuff up here and ended up being the first administrator at United Health Services, which
was
later on became DaySpring, I
right.
guess.
Yeah.
Really?
Claire Fieldman. And I remember I lived in Lake City then, and I drove to Petros and drove to Stony Fork and drove to Norma to see patients. And Bill would come down. He lived in Kerrville, I guess, or Jacksboro, I guess.
Jacksboro, yeah.
Yeah. And I remember sitting out on my porch, and he had a whole list of national health plans, because that was a big thing back then.
Right.
There was a Kennedy plan, there was a Javits plan, there were all these plans for national health insurance. And to make a long story short, and I actually, through a fortuitous circumstance, helped him get this job, but he got a job in Washington working with the House Subcommittee on Health and Environment, which originally was Paul Rogers' committee, who was my congressman from Florida, and my father knew him. But anyway, he ended up staying with that committee, and that was Don Waxman's committee. And all the healthcare bills in Congress started in that committee.
Including 330 funding.
Yeah, so he was involved in that for 25 years. And then when Tom Daschle became the majority leader in the Senate, he was his chief of staff. And when Obama came in, Bill was for 7 years the Deputy Secretary of HHS. In other words, he was the number two person to Sebelius while Obamacare, the ACA, was being developed. And he's all part of our group. I mean, we just had a meeting in Nashville and he was there. And I just actually had dinner with him in D.C. when I was there a month ago. And he knows exactly what's going on behind the scenes.
Right.
And this was at a time when no one had really heard much about the Cassidy bill. And he said, keep an eye out for this, because this is coming down the pike. And sure enough, you know, a week later, suddenly it emerged. But he was an administrator up here.
In Clairfield and Laura Fork.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So what is now DaySpring, you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
He was the first administrator there.
Yep.
And the doc was Jesse Walker.
Right, who was in Jellicoe, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So there's all kinds of interesting...
It's just amazing. The connections and how influential they've been from just this general area of these... Sounds like these clinics have been extremely... Maybe that's... you all won't say it, but I will. From my perspective, talking to... the different people that have been involved, it seems like there's been some very influential people from this little group of clinics that have gone on to really have an impact on community health centers.
Right.
And they've gone into education. I mean, I was associate vice president for education at the University of Florida for years. A number of people have gone on into education, and most of us have been involved in setting up education in rural areas, trying to get students out of the hospitals and into the communities and doing home visits and working in rural areas. So it's really an interesting group of people, which is probably one reason you got interested in this, I think, in the first place.
Just all the networks and the tendrils, as we call them, right, as they lead out to other things. It's just
they're fascinating. Involved in everything from, you know, coal mining, mm-hmm, strip mining, stopping strip mining, to, you know, water quality and legal issues having to do, mm-hmm, with nurse practitioners, and all out of Vanderbilt.
Well, that's some of the things that I will wait and ask you, because that to me is fascinating, talking about the prescribing the drugs and how that kind of led, and I'm sure it wasn't just
Irwin's going to be here for,
right?
Isn't he coming for lunch? Didn't he say?
Yes. Yeah, he said he'd
so he should be here soon.
Lunchtime.
And he was, and he's the lawyer that took it to the state, in the first place.
Well, so those are two things that I would like to talk to the staff about, besides asking them questions. I'd like to tell them about what the early, mountain peoples was, and, what were the sites and so forth. And then I would like to tell them about how mountain peoples got involved in public policy. I think that's a pretty interesting story for people to know about. But what I'd like to do now is just talk to you about you.
Hard topic.
Yes.
Carol, as we start, can we frame it a little bit? Just say where we are, the date, and then could each of you introduce yourselves since Paul and I are now rolling?
Okay. We are at the administrative offices of Mountain People's Health Councils in Oneida, Tennessee. And... I'm Carol Carpenter, and I was the second administrator at Mountain Peoples 40 years ago. And I'm part of a project to try to help document the evolution of Mountain Peoples from the health fairs to today. And with me is Rick Davidson. You can introduce yourself.
I'm Rick Davidson. I was the first physician at Mountain People's Health Councils, which at the time was Pete Ross, Stony Fork, and Norma. And that was in 74, stayed here 74 through 76, and actually had to then return and complete my residency because I left in the middle of it. But I had been working up in this area for a number of years earlier than that. Basically as a medical student doing health fairs that came through a lot of these smaller communities. And I understand you actually...
I think I was at one.
You were at one. Yeah.
Which health fairs were you affiliated with?
Well, not Petros, Stony Fork, and Norma, because I was an intern that year.
Uh-huh.
And they weren't about to let me out to do that.
Right.
But the health fairs that we did were in... Clairfield, Briceville, White Oak, Mud Creek, Kentucky, Habersham, up in the Clear Fork Valley, Sneedville, in Hancock County, and I'm sure there are some that I'm not. Deer Lodge. I worked the first year as a second year medical student. That would have been in the summer of 1970, and then in 71 I directed the program, and we had 110 students, and we actually had two concurrent health fairs going on then in a variety of different places, and we managed to get Tennessee Valley Authority to loan us two of their multi-phase screening vans, big silver vans that they would take around to their TVA sites and screen their employees. So they gave us people to run them, and we put them in these little mountain communities and in front of a school, and we do health fairs there. And we would have people, mostly undergraduates, some law students, who would stay in each community for the entire summer. And they would help organize food for the health fair workers, mostly churches. A lot of churches would donate food. they'd each take a day of the week, and they'd bring fried chicken and green beans. Ate more fried chicken and green beans than ever in my life. And they would also provide homes for us, the people that were the examiners, who were medical students, nursing students. We had a few people to help run the lab, and we had a supervising physician who was the chief resident at Vanderbilt Pediatrics, whose name was Pete Moss. And we would go to these communities, and we'd do health fairs, but the people that were assigned to the communities would stay there and help get community people together and form health councils. And then we would have lawyers and law students look into ways of getting funding for these health councils. And that's how Mountain People's Health Councils really began. There were three health councils that were had organized themselves and wanted docs. And so that's what happened.
Right.
So I guess that was kind of the precursors to federally qualified health centers before they had the 330 and the rules and the regulations that it sounds like you guys were ahead of the game and already setting it up. And
we had our issues, yeah. I mean, there were nurse practice was a major one.
I'm going to hold this for when we meet with the staff.
Pharmacy issues. We were operating, I would say, on the margins of legality.
And that's being, what we think your staff being, will enjoy hearing
and that's
about.
Being generous.
So, what I find interesting, James, this is James Levitt, who is the current CEO of Mountain People's Health Councils. And we wanted to spend time at this point in our visit to talk to him about the fact that you went to a health fair when you were a child and kind of how you got from that to where you are today.
Well, I'll start with the health fair. I kind of shared that with you a little bit.
Yes.
I remember it being up at Norman. I figured I was probably about 7 or 8 years old. And the reason I remember it is because I think it was something, it may have had to do with, just a health fair in the community, or it may have been tied with one of the coal companies. You know, they were there for their employees.
No, it was definitely a student health coalition, fair.
So it was one of those that, I'm trying to remember back, but I can remember walking around, because you went from station to station. And I came up to one station, and this is why I remember it, because I remember the nurse at the little table, and of course my mom's behind me, and they say, can I have your finger? So I give them my hand, and then it was either my mom or the nurse. I give the nurse full credit for this, and they were like, they try to distract me off to the side. Well, out comes the little puncture device that they had. You know, the little silver thing, kind of looks like a tooth.
Yeah.
And they poke my finger. And to this day, I still don't really trust nurses. but I can remember that vividly. I mean, and that's all I remember. I remember going from station to station, but I remember them squeezing my finger. Yeah. And, they had that little silver thing that they would poke, and they would put the little drop of blood. But as soon as I turned away, she got me.
Yep. She knew what she was doing.
Yes, she did.
Was it in school?
No, it was. It may have been. I remember it being in Norman, and I believe that it was there at the clinic. I really believe that, because it seems like I can remember going around to the bottom where they had something set up. Mm-hmm. But the biggest thing that stuck in my mind was the poke. So there wasn't a whole lot more of that. That kind of left a lasting impression.
Where were you living at the time? Where was your family? Were you from Norma?
No, actually, we were from Oneida.
Uh huh.
And now, I've always said that if you've been in Scott County or if your family's been here, everybody's from Norma. Or has relatives up there. And
is
I've
that
got,
right?
You know, the Penningtons, the Andersons, those were my grandparents, and they were directly from the Norma and Smoky area.
Uh-huh.
So, And that's why we had ties. You know, we were always going back up, you know, when I was that young to see my grandmother's parents were still alive.
Uh-huh.
And those are, you know, we would go up to their house and visit. And so we were always up there.
Right.
Like I said, with the Anderson family and the Penningtons, that's a large group of people from our family that's uh-huh. from up in that area. So that's what our ties were.
So you grew up in Oneida?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's born and raised, and, you know, left to get my degree from the University of Tennessee. After that, I lived in Chattanooga for several years, and then lived in Knoxville for several years. And when I was in Chattanooga, I began working at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Tennessee.
Oh, okay.
So that's kind of how I got in the healthcare side, on the other team, of course.
Uh-huh.
But,
yes.
Yeah. But so I spent a lot of time there. And then when I moved to Knoxville, I was actually with Blue Cross for a long time.
Uh-huh.
Had the opportunity to come back to manage a clinic in Scott County. And we just decided it was time. You know, it's funny, when I left Scott County, and I shouldn't say Scott County, I guess it's any small town. You know, when you grow up in a small town, it gets a little old that everybody knows your name and everybody knows what your business was. I can tell you that when I was growing up, if we ever got in trouble and they said it was one of the Lovett boys, that narrowed it down to two. So there wasn't a whole lot of room to hide. And you know, as after I went to school, I wasn't real keen on moving back. I mm-hmm. just wanted to see something else. But the reason I say that is because after years of living in Chattanooga and after years of living in Knoxville, I never really got to know my neighbors that much. And I really kind of missed knowing who's around you.
Yeah,
and it was, you just always seemed to be, you know, everybody was an acquaintance in those towns, but you really knew the people you went to school with and stuff like that. You miss home.
Uh-huh.
So we moved back here, and a couple of years later, you know, I was working at an office up in Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
And we had converted it over to a rural health clinic.
Okay.
And in the process of converting it over to a rural health clinic, I had discovered community health centers. And I think I just talked to Paul about this earlier. Had no idea what they were.
Uh-huh.
But I was fascinated by what they were able to do and how they, you know, the money that was available to go out into the community and how you could really make a difference. And I was just, this is so neat. So I started looking at it in the context of, did we want to go further from a rural health onto a community health center?
Uh-huh.
You know, I was talking to the providers, they were real excited, but I told them, I said, you really can't do that. I said, if you want to maintain ownership of the practice, you've got to be a rural health clinic, because if you're an FQHC, then that becomes its own entity and you no longer own it. But in reading the material for the FQHC, you know, as I was learning more about it, I read somewhere in the material that it said, you know, community health centers are oftentimes confused with the health department, or mm-hmm. people consider them a form of the health department. And that struck me, because I had always, you know, growing up here, I knew about Mountain Peoples,
right.
but I never understood it
uh-huh.
at all. But I remember people saying, well, it's kind of like the health department. And right then I knew, I was like, is Mountain Peoples a federally qualified health center? And I started looking into it and finding out, and lo and behold, it was. And like I said, I was fascinated by the thoughts of what you could do if you were an FQHC. And then to discover that this awesome setup was sitting in Scott County. I mean, I was really kind of amazed, because I like I said, I never knew what Mountain Peoples was, and now I realize that it's this really cool setup. And it would have ended there, but it's amazing. Just, I don't know the time frame, but it could have been a year or two later. You know, Jan was sick and had passed away.
Jan Laxton was the administrator, and yep. she, when I was here, she had been secretary.
Yep, and it's, so when she passed, I had just, it's kind of amazing how it happened, for me to find that, to be so amazed by what it was capable of, to realize Mountain Peoples was actually that kind of organization, and then for there to be an opening right immediately after that. It all came back to back, literally.
Yep.
I mean, in a short amount of time. I mean, within a year or two of me really kind of discovering, not because I was interested in Mountain Peoples, because I was interested in FQHCs, and then discovered Mountain Peoples was an FQHC. And then for there to be an opening. But I know as we went through the interview process at Mountain Peoples, I had the most unfair thing somebody did to me. They came back and we interviewed, and I really liked where I was at. I really liked what we were trying to do. And I said, you know, I'm going to stay with that. And so I said, you know, that I didn't want the position as the executive director. Come to find out later on, as they continued to search, my name came back around. And when I was talking to one of the board members, I said, listen, I really just want to, I'm amazed at some of the things we're going to be able to do. I said, we're going to be able to take care. We've got programs that we're going to be able to put in place in the community. I said, this is exciting stuff. And I went on and on. And he listened to me, didn't say a word. And he said, at the end, he said, well, he said, that's amazing. He said, why don't you come do that for the people you grew up with? And that just, and I paraphrase, I don't know if that's exactly what he said, but yeah. After I went on, and him not saying anything, and then at the end, because, you know, I was all excited about what I was going to be able to do, and he said, why don't you come do that for us? And I don't know, I guess it just resonated.
Sure.
And now that's why I'm the executive director of Mountain Peoples. But, you know, it's one thing that I can tell you that, you know, with the experience that I have with Blue Cross and Blue Shield, the contracting, the fact that we had, and I'll use old terms, but the HCFA 1500s and the UV-92s, which right. is hospital claims. And in an FQHC, you right. deal a lot with having to bill for both of those, and the claim experience, and I was actually a consultant for Blue Cross, so I went out to the different practices, and you know, you learn the operation. It all seemed to kind of culminate in the opportunity, and I just find it amazing that right, all those things came back to back right after I found out about Mountain Peoples, or like I said, I wasn't even looking at Mountain Peoples, looking at something else. And then the opportunity presented itself. So I can tell you that I love what I do. And being able to reach out and help people that need help,
mm-hmm.
Making sure that people have access to care. I don't know. I guess that just kind of lights my fire to keep figuring out a way to do it and bring in more services and stuff like that. It's just constantly a challenge.
And what was it? What was it like coming home?
It was nice. You know, one of the first things, and one of the reasons that I came home, we had small, you know, I've got two daughters, and they were small at the time. And I can remember I always seemed to be sitting in traffic.
I mean, when you were in Knoxville.
When I was in Knoxville. I mean, you know, it's not the weight on
that
the red
light. That was true 40 years ago.
I mean, it's not the one red light. It was, you had to work, and the red light would turn green, you would drive up, and you would sit and wait on another cycle, because I lived in West Knoxville. And me and my wife had noticed that, you know, on the rare occasions that we did get to go out, and that was literally, I mean, from 10 minutes from the time I got in my car, I could be out and in any eatery in West Knoxville. But I can remember there was once we went out, and we were walking through the door of this steakhouse. By the time I fought traffic, got there, got the babysitter, we went out. And I remember passing somebody from Oneida when I was walking. They were done. And I remember they were like, hey, how's it going? And I'm like, and I remember I turned to my wife and I said, you know, they're an hour and a half away.
Yeah.
And they're finishing and we're just now getting here. I said, we're doing something wrong. So that was one of the reasons. It was just kind of a slower pace. You know, I came home and one of the first things I noticed is I came up to a red light. And I remember looking down, and it was like 5 or 6 o'clock. And I was doing something, and I looked up. I was the only one at the red light in any direction.
Uh-huh.
And I know that sounds bad, and that doesn't happen very often in Scott Kelly even, but for whatever reason, that was just the affirmation that I had made the right choice. Because I looked up, I was first one in line, and there was nobody else in my way. And that's when I realized I was home, because it was tremendously different than what Knoxville was all about.
Right.
So it was neat. And, you know, coming home is you get to be back around friends and family.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're in places like Knoxville and others, and there's stuff to do, and you make friends, and I had some good friends in those places, but it's, you know, the friends that you went to high school with, the friends that you grew up with, friends that you got in trouble with, the friends that still know stuff that nobody else knows. You know, we've all got those. It was just nice being home.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't regretted.
Well, I was thinking that that you really do have a great combination of skills and knowledge, because you're a local person, so you know everybody. But you've got this background with Blue Cross. And you've worked in clinic management, and those are all things that I don't think other administrators, myself included, had when we worked here. We were missing one piece or another. But sometimes knowing everybody isn't an advantage.
No.
I mean, was that true for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's when you're in a small town, you do know it. And you know families. And I won't say that it's a disadvantage. You know, I'm very fortunate that it was. Now, it can be. If you've ever done something you're not supposed to and the whole town knew, oh, it would be a disadvantage. You know, fortunately, I didn't fit into that category. But, you know, we use that to our advantage in the hiring process. The great thing about everybody knowing you is that everybody does know you. So when you're hiring, you can actually use that to you know what they're all about.
Right.
And you've grown up with them. You know the family. You know, and so it makes it a little easier to select the level of person that you're looking for. That doesn't always work, but if you can show me a foolproof hiring process, I'd be more than happy to write it down and use it. But, you know...
See, this is kind of the difference from... We were actually talking about this on the way up here, that in a little tiny town...
Like Norma.
Or Stony Fork, where the jobs may be related only to people on the board, that it could really generate some hard feelings within the community. And that was true in a lot of these tiny communities back at that point in time, and led to problems.
Well, we figured that in places like Norma, Stony Fork, and Petros, the clinic jobs might be the only jobs in town, you know, in right there. So the fact that many of the employees were related to board members was a problem, and yet it seemed almost inevitable given the fact that those were kind of prime jobs to have.
Well, and I would like to think that, you know, the jobs at Mountain Peoples, and we work hard to make sure that we pay well and that we take care of our employees, because we ask a lot of them, and our expectations are high. But you know, with since I have been here, and I think they may have had some issues at one point in time. I won't say that they resulted in anything negative, but other than that maybe hard feelings at times. I can't employ any of my family, you know, the anti-nepotism. And I don't have a problem with that. I've got great family members that do a wonderful job. But
they didn't have that. They didn't have those rules back then.
Right.
In those communities.
And it makes for a really awkward Christmas.
Yes, exactly. Things,
you know? But, you know, the good thing about it is, you know, not having that. And in small towns, because jobs are so scarce, and because you do want to, we are clannish. Scott County is no different than any other small town. Every small town's clannish.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if they say they're not, they're lying. And they're protecting the clan. They're all clannish. Because, you know, clannish is that you kind of know, and relationships are right. What rule the day.
Yeah.
And when you have a nonprofit, let's say, or a and it's usually where it happens, is you get that nepotism because they're trying to bring them in and they're trying to help the family and stuff like that. And oh yeah, I it still happens to this day.
Yeah.
I mean, where you see them bringing in their family members to work, and that is fine if they're the most qualified. But, you know, in a lot of cases, they may not necessarily
be. Well, once you reach a certain size, though, you can put in policies and things like
right.
that.
Yes.
And that those were things that these groups had to learn the hard way.
Well, I'm sure back in your day, if you weren't very helping to the people that could help you, then you probably wouldn't have gotten off the ground. So you're right. Once we got big enough, it was kind of a luxury to be able to say you will and won't do this in terms of hiring.
And in some cases, I think the people that we, when we were doing this from the beginning, and we identified people, our people that lived in the communities, that, you know, the idea was to identify community leaders. Well, you know, when you're identifying community leaders in small towns like that, they tend to be strong-willed, capable, but opinionated at times people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because that's the kind of people that you need to pull something like that together.
Yep.
But that doesn't sit well with the other clans, as you put it. And, you know, it was a learning experience for us, too, in terms of how to go about, you know, trying to get people in some of these communities together. And you know, you could address, if you take three totally separate communities with this clannishness going on in each of those communities and then combine them into one group, and here's your administrator,
right.
Each of which have, you know, their own needs and wants and desires. So Carol had She had an interesting job.
Yeah, I must admit that when I ended up here doing these interviews because after I'd been to a meeting with the Student Health Coalition alumni, I went on the website and I looked up Mountain Peoples, and I was absolutely flabbergasted.
As was I.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, first of all, this makes sense. You know, you're an all Scott County organization, and just the scope of it was so, you know, different from when we were here, and I, you know, I said I want to know how they got from there to here, because I do think it's an organization that makes sense. It didn't make a lot of sense when I was here. I mean, the three clinics were in three different counties.
Yeah.
They oriented in three different directions in terms of
different patient populations.
Right.
They had, you know, they had different needs within the communities.
Yep.
You know, I mean, Petros at least was, Petros and Norma were at least part of you know, the culture in these. I mean, Stony Fork essentially was, you know, a crossroads way up in the mountains, you know.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah. That's, I mean.
That's what we talked about, trying to get up there is.
There used to be a way from Norma to Pete to Stony Fork, but you had to cross a creek to get there.
Right.
Yeah, we
were talking about that.
I remember that.
But I think they came together out of necessity because there was no way any of the clinics by themselves could have gotten a National Health Service Corps physician, could have gotten a grant for 330 money. But there was always a certain amount of suspicion about, you know, is Norma getting more than Stony Fork or Petros getting more than Norma?
As you're talking about that, I've really worked hard the last several years to kind of break that mentality because our board member was more like, most board members consider themselves a delegate from whatever clinic.
In their community.
And I'm like,
right.
You're there to represent them and to share the concerns, but we work together as one, as Mountain Peoples.
Right.
And I've had to really work hard because people would lean heavily towards their own particular clinic at the detriment, potentially, of the organization. I'm like, we're not doing that. Please share with us your concerns or your issues, and we'll do everything we can. You know, with Norma, I know that Norma was closed when I got here.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, and I reopened. I didn't
realize that.
And I thought it was important. I mean, it was who we are.
Right.
I mean, even to this day. So back when you all started it, we still consider that. And that was a population of people up in Norma that we wanted to make sure that I got that clinic back open. And we've opened it, and it hasn't closed since. And they've embraced it. But I know early on it was like, you're spending...
Taking resources away from us.
Why are you building a new building in Oneida? And you didn't... Like, guys, there's not enough patient base in this area or that versus the one we're building. But, you know, I actually had to have that conversation with people in Norma. They're like, well, we'll... I said, you all have to use the clinic or it will not stay open. Well, you all closed it, and we're just not sure. I said, and I think this is where being from Scott County helps.
Right.
Absolutely.
As I said, let me explain something. You keep passing that clinic, and I'll close it. I said, we ain't waiting on... We have to have people coming in the door, and patients.
Right.
And if you continue to drive past... I said, so tell the community, if they want that clinic to stay open, you better start utilizing it.
Yep.
Because if it's not needed, I need to use those resources.
I remember Norma even back then.
Yeah.
People were driving to Oneida from Norma to see docs. And, you know, part of it was that, you know, we had a nurse practitioner. Actually, she was a midwife who was there every day. And then I would spend a day and a half there a week. And that was part of it because it was a new concept and
nurse practitioners.
And
would that have been like either Betty Stanley or Judy Gordon?
No. Sally Kimberly.
Hey,
Irwin.
You are. We've just had a new arrival.
Can we fit him in over there?
Yeah.
I just got a message from Sherry. This is very important.
Okay.
She wants to know that. Whether we want, we should have homemade chili or hot dogs or both.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad to have you.
I'll show you.
We're going to feed you lunch here in just a minute.
Well, that's great.
Maybe both.
I'm sorry, I'm just human.
Are you guys off now or are you still on?
I'm rolling.
Okay. Irwin, you have to introduce yourself for the record.
For the record. I am Irwin Bennick, for the record.
and
what?
Well, what do you have to do with all this?
What do I have to do with all this? I was a law student and lived in Petros. When the first health fair went through Petros, that gave rise to the formation of the Petros Clinic that eventually sort of morphed into what then became People's Health Council. And that all happened 45 years ago. And then since that time, I was involved in the organization of the Tennessee Primary Care Association, and still work with the Primary Care Association after all these years. Is that sufficient?
If that's good, yes. When we meet with the staff and talk about some of the public policy stuff, we'll connect Irwin in.
I think they're real excited to hear some of that. You know, I'd love to hear how Mountain Peoples is tied with, and you don't have to answer that now, that'll come, but how you all got together to form the Tennessee Primary Care Association.
Right.
Those are stories that, you know, most of the people that the staff at Mountain Peoples don't know about.
They're myth.
Is it all a myth?
They're myth.
Legend.
So, actually, just to wind up what we were talking about, I think that there's sort of a double-edged sword in starting something like a community clinic, because you want to have the community connections, and yet sometimes those connections keep some people from using the clinic. As I recall, that was more of a problem in Stony Fork and Petros than it was in Norma. But it sounds like there must have come a point where even Norma had the most patients of the three clinics. Must have been a point at which there weren't enough.
I think that, and still to this day, you know, there's only one provider in Scott County that's outside the town of Oneida, other than Mountain Peoples.
Right.
And he used to work at Mountain Peoples.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that's why everybody comes in to Oneida. But when the, you know, it's up to us to make sure that they've got a solid or dependable provider base. And sometimes... Mm-hmm. That was hard. You know, in the early stages, we really kind of struggled with stabilizing the provider base.
Mm-hmm.
We've been able to do that. But once they realize that we're here, we're going to be here, you know, I understand when they were passing it after it reopened, they had to feel like, well, I'm not going to switch from Dr. So-and-so back up to Norma because I don't know if that place is going to be closed.
Mm.
And that's just something over time that you have to demonstrate. You know, like, yes, you know, when you're from a small town, maybe somebody, even the local gets an opportunity, I still have to win them over,
mm-hmm.
the same way that a stranger does. I just get more bonus points because... they know me, they know my grandmother, they know the family, you know. And you, they don't. But I still have to make sure I'm taking care of them and demonstrating to them that I care about. If I've demonstrated that and I'm from the community and they know that's who I am, then you get an instant buy.
Uh-huh.
If I'm from the area but they don't really know me, then... You get the preferential placement, but you don't get an automatic buy. Nobody does here. I don't feel like. You know, it's just like with the physicians. We've had some local physicians here, and it's like, well, we really want local physicians. Well, I can tell you that a local physician will get the buy early on. But I can tell you we've had local physicians that did not do well at all here, and we've had people that have come in that... obviously from somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
and were loved. I see it as the people in Scott County, to me, I think if you demonstrate that you care, then they'll do everything they can to support you. If you demonstrate that you're on their team and you genuinely care, then you're accepted in. And even if you're a local, we would like for you to, but if you don't care, they'll dump you.
Mm-hmm.
They may give you longer of an opportunity to come around, so to speak. But even if you're from here, if you don't care about them, people in Scott County will dump you like they should. I mean, it's really about the relationships.
Yep.
And even if you're from here, you still have to demonstrate that. But I won't kid you. You do get a vibe being from the community, as you would anywhere.
Sure.
You know, if you were from the borough in New York or something, you know, and they knew you, you're going to get a vibe there too. It's no different there than it is anywhere. You know, I guess we all live in our own little clans, no matter how big the place we happen to live. But Scott County's no different.
I was interested because on the on your website, there's some language referring to assuring access. And I wondered if that had to do with a place like Norma, that you'd be committed to some of the areas that are, you know, further away from Oneida or Huntsville, and whether that was something important that you had to state as an organization to be able to operate in a place like Norma.
Well, I mean, it's the access question. I mean, it's, and, you know, this day and time, you think that, gosh, they could get to Walmart. Everybody goes to Walmart. You know, talking about that's a small town. That's the major, you know, employer, and that's where all the goods are. That's where you can get your milk, your tires, and your battery, and the fishing pole all at the same time. But those are, and I've forgotten my train of thought as I was saying that.
In terms of why couldn't people just come to Oneida? Why did you need a Norma or a Winfield?
Well, it's, you know, and I apologize, I remember now, it's, you still have people that have a hard time getting from Norma down to Oneida.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think of it, but yeah, it's, they have limited resources and they may not have a car that can get there. And so to us, it's important in Norma. We're the only ones that are in Winfield.
Mm-hmm.
We're the only ones that are in Robbins.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one other in the town of Huntsville.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I said, that person actually used to work at Mountain Vehicles. But we're the only ones in those communities. And we feel like it's very important to make sure that we continue to provide that level of access for them. Would it be easier to just come down here and have a massive building with all the providers? Yes. But that's not our mission. Our mission is to make sure that we provide quality care in an accessible manner. And having those clinics out in the community. And you know, it gives a community a sense of pride to have their clinic
in. Sure.
I could tell Norma was not happy that they had lost their clinic.
Yeah,
when I got.
I never realized that had happened.
And that's one thing that I had to share with them as we were talking. I'm like, because the community or several from the community would call. They were, why are you doing this? I said, you all need to remember, I reopened it. I didn't close it. So...
Right.
Bear with me.
Yeah.
I'm working on making sure that clinic is stable. And they love the clinic. Not only there, they love the clinic in all the places I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a sense of pride. Our clinics right now, if I went from our Winfield clinic on the Kentucky border down to Robbins or even maybe into Norma, I mean, you're going to be traveling 30, 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some distances between all of them.
Right.
And not everybody has gas money to go 45 minutes down the road or an hour and a half back by the time you get there and back.
Mm-hmm.
It's important for us to make sure that we continue to have that level of access in those communities.
Right.
'Cause that's who we are.
Well, when I say that Mountain Peoples makes sense in a way it didn't before... The original clinics of Mountain Peoples were focused on creating access for very small communities. And when you put three of those together, it's not a very strong arrangement. As I said, it doesn't make a lot of sense because they're in three different counties. But now that you have sort of a base in Huntsville and Oneida, it's easier to assure access to those other sites than it would have been in when I was here.
Yeah, and the Oneida, we had, you know, we just expanded it. You know, those three providers over there, we've got room for a fourth. The only reason there's not a fourth is because we opened a dental clinic, and we had to use the space to do that. Mm-hmm. So we're actively looking to build another building now to be able to pull them out so that we can get somebody else. We could run six providers down here. I really feel comfortable saying that. We just need the space. But we are very cautious not to pull them to where it would be detrimental to our own clinics. Not from a money perspective, because, I mean, we're either seeing them there or seeing them here.
Yeah.
But it's, you still want to leave access for people out in those communities, because the person who might switch and come into the Oneida clinic if there was more space here instead of going to the Elgin clinic, well, there's also somebody in Elgin that goes to the Elgin clinic because it's convenient, it's close, and it's in
yes,
Elgin.
Yes, right.
And those things are still important, right. And we want to make sure that we maintain it.
I'm going to interrupt because I think we're due at the Oneida Clinic to
yes.
meet with your staff.
Yes, and when we go over there, I will let you guys in. We're going to let you eat first.
Oh, thank you.
we're tough, but we're not slave drivers.
We can sing for our supper if we have to.
Absolutely. But after that, a lot of the questions, I've been holding back. I've got several.
Yeah. Okay.
So, but we appreciate y'all coming, and when we go over there, we'll eat. And there'll be a lot of the staff members there that don't be afraid to share that they haven't heard these stories. I think you can look from my eyes as you all are talking, I'm like, wow, I did not know that.
Yeah.
So we're glad
to
have you.
I think they'll find it interesting how we broke the law.
Hello.
Broke the law.